Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz drummer and band leader David Potter. He took some time to talk to us about his latest 2022 project called Retro Groove. It's coming out on March 22nd. The CD was formed out of the desire to solve a decades-old question from audience members about why jazz bands don't play more modern recognizable songs. And he covers the popular music from the 1980s as a response. He is a native of North Carolina and began playing the drums in high school, and he's never stopped. Enjoy the story.
Hey, thanks for taking a minute out for the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate checking out the music and talking to me.
Yeah, man. You know, so I like the approach here with Retro Groove, you know, taking all of these, like, hits that we are very, very cognizant of in our popular culture consciousness and turning it into jazz. Talk to me a little bit about, like, not only that concept, but it's coming out during a very strange time with COVID and limited live shows and all of that. How does this really feel?
The impetus, the inspiration for this kind of came about just from years and years and years of playing jazz and the types of questions that I would get, and I think a lot of jazz musicians would get, would be something along the lines of, hey, I really like what y'all are doing. I enjoyed the show. Do you guys ever play any more modern music? Or do you guys ever play any songs that are on the radio or anything that we know that we would sing along to? You know, obviously, and these are non-traditional jazz fans or maybe first-time jazz listeners that really enjoyed the concept, maybe the grooves, the swing, the improvisation, the energy, the conversation and interaction, but they had a hard time with it or maybe struggled because they just aren't familiar with songs from the Great American Songbook or even from the traditional jazz catalog, you know, music by Thelonious Monk or Charlie Parker or, you know, John Coltrane. And so what I kind of was thinking about was, is there a way, and again, I don't want to take credit for trying to be the first person to have this idea, but trying to think of, is there a way to play some more well-known music, but also still kind of walk that line where we're still conceptually playing what we would play over, like, a standard or a song, you know, written by Wayne Shorter, and trying to bridge that gap. Is it possible to do that? And it took me about 2 years to find the right songs and to come up with the right arrangements in order to be able to do that, because I feel like looking through the catalog of popular music, I thought about doing more recent stuff, like stuff in the past 10 or 20 years, and I really had a hard time just finding songs that had enough malleable material, enough in the foundation to be able to make into a jazz song, because the one big thing that I did not want to do, which I think a lot of people have done in the past, is they'll take a song, they'll take a popular song, but they end up reharmonizing it, they rearrange it, they change the melody so much that it's almost unrecognizable from an original fan of that artist or song can't sing along to it. And I tried to really find a way to say, okay, one of my songs, if you're a big Doobie Brothers fan and you like, you know, What a Fool Believes, can I craft a version of that, you know, fans of that song and that era and that music will be able to sing along to and follow along to, but also traditional jazz fans or somebody that's looking for a more hardcore jazz concept can still groove on and can still appreciate. So that's kind of where that came from, if that makes sense.
So I'm curious how you got the jazz bug. How did all of this begin for you, this journey into the jazz?
Good question. So I did not come from one of these music generation after generation dynasty kind of families. Oddly enough, I played with Jason Marsalis for many years, and, you know, we all know about his family. I came from the opposite of that. I'm the only professional musician in my family as far out as I've been able to find. Really, it was a strange kind of turn of events because I was really into sports growing up and thought at one point I might want to be a comedian of all things. And I was actually getting into some trouble with grades and just some little juvenile delinquency-esque stuff. And my mom said, you know, I think music is going to be a good outlet for you. So she kind of made me actually play in the band, like the school band. And I picked drums because I thought they would be the easiest thing to learn because I had no interest in doing it. I was just being made to by my mom. Ended up finding out pretty quickly that I had somewhat just of a natural affinity for it. I had a natural passion for it. After, you know, 2 years of playing, you know, rock and roll and hip hop and funk and just popular music, I was a really big fan of Dennis Chambers. I actually got a hold back in the days when VHS instructional tapes were all the rage. I got a hold of some of his, I think it was DCI was the company maybe back then that was producing a lot of that stuff. They had one with Jocko, and Chick Corea did a couple of cool ones, but he did some with John Scofield's quartet, actually. And the guy that was interviewing him asked him, hey, what are some of the drummers that you checked out coming up? And he started naming, you know, people like Tony Williams and Philly Joe Jones and Elvin Jones and Art Blakey. And I was just kind of like, who in the world are these guys? You know, and I hadn't heard of them and wasn't really interested in them. But from a logical standpoint, I said, well, if Dennis Chambers is my man and I want to be able to sound like him, I need to, and also Billy Cobham is somebody that I was big into at that point, then I need to kind of follow that rabbit hole down and try to find people that he checked out. And so Tony Williams was the first one that I said, okay, let me check some of his stuff out. And I got some of the Lifetime records, like Million Dollar Legs and Emergency. I didn't understand it. And actually, my ego was the thing that helped in this point. My cockiness and my ego about, you know, how I could just understand instantly anything that I was listening to and I could try and play it back, how ignorant I was at that point is crazy. But, you know, going in and checking out that and just realizing I don't understand conceptually like anything that Tony Williams is playing. And then getting into the stuff with Miles, you know, when I heard the record Four and More, that live record with Miles's quintet, it just completely blew me away. And I was so curious and so frustrated that I couldn't do what he was doing and I couldn't even understand when and why and where and how and all of that stuff. I started checking out more records, and then my junior year of high school, I had a teacher come in that was a trumpet player, a jazz trumpet player, and I started asking him questions about how the music is. He's like, well, you need to check the records out. So I would borrow his tapes and his CDs and just listen to them, and I would force myself. I remember some of the first records I got were Art Blakey's Moaning, Thelonious Monk's Monk's Dream, John Coltrane's Giant Steps. And I remember listening to these records and kind of having to force myself. I remember, like, with Art Blakey's Moaning, I said, I'm going to listen to this record from end to end, and I'm not going to let myself out of my room. And it was kind of torture at that point because I didn't understand it. I didn't even really have a total affinity for the music at that point. But after a while, it just kind of started to sink in. And, you know, within a few months, jazz was it for me. And ever since then, you know, it's just been a total love affair and a passion for jazz music.
What do you look forward to the most about being a professional musician? Each day you wake up, you have the opportunity to do this. What is the best part of it?
I think being able to kind of take people in a performance situation, a live performance situation, be able to take people away from the stresses and pains and rigors of everyday life and kind of transport them into another deep dimension, even if but for a brief set period of time, because that's what music has always done for me. It's been an escape. It's been therapy. It's been, you know, something that can comfort me, something that's been almost like cathartic to hear and play, and to be able to do that for other people, just that's really it for me.
Everyone has a perception of you, an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of yourself. Who do you think you are?
Wow, that's a deep, good one. And it's funny, too, because I think one of the things, and I think about this from time to time, one of the things that all of us can do is you start to perceive yourself and your self-worth based off of your career output or your passion for your art or your hobby or whatever. For a long time, I think, you know, perceiving myself just as a musician, as a drummer, and then working back from that. But, you know, as I get older, trying to look at life a little bit bigger than that. I mean, music is everything to me on the one hand, but on the other hand, trying to think about myself, am I being nice to people? Am I working as hard as I can to make myself a better person and grow as a human being and help out my community, help out my family, be a good father to my daughter, a good husband, a good brother and son and all of those things. Try to be patient with people and understand that, that, you know, everybody's going through their journey and you can never really understand what's going on in someone's life just by having a conversation with them or having one single interaction with them. You know, everybody behaves the way they do for a reason. And also, the older I get, trying to cut myself slack sometimes when either my personality flaws or my playing are not where I want them to be, and just realizing, you know, this is an unfinished product. This thing is in progress. You know, everything, even with my recordings, you know, recording can be very obsessive and compulsive, especially trying to capture like jazz music in a sterile environment like a recording studio and trying to generate the same level of intensity and energy and interaction that we would in a live setting. Just trying to cut myself, yeah, just be understanding that, you know, this is part of the journey, part of the path, and it's a snapshot in time of where we all were in that moment that doesn't have to define us for the rest of our lives, hopefully.
Right on, man. I like that answer. Hey, thank you for opening up about the album. Good luck with it. Good luck with the return to the stage. I appreciate your time.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest cats in North Carolina, Kansas City, and spots all over the world giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Dave for his time, music, and stories. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.